Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, Congressman Jim Costa joins us to talk about water and the Valley and the stalled negotiations in Congress that some fear might mean the Valley could miss a golden opportunity to capture some of this expected El Nino precipitation that's headed our way. We'll also take a look back at some of the top stories of 2015 with Robert Price of the Bakersfield Californian and Evan Onstott of KC24. And we'd like to know your thoughts on the top local news of 2015. Was it the Rough Fire? Was it the stabbing at UC Merced? Or Kevin McCarthy's brief flirtation with the office of Speaker of the House? There's lots of great fodder for that discussion later on in our show, and you can send us your comments. Tweet us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. Right now, though, we turn our attention to something that's about to be in the news in 2016, and that's high-speed rail. Ready or not, here it comes. Wrecking balls and bulldozers will start their work early next year on projects connected to high-speed rail, and it could impact how you get around Fresno. But as Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports, it's just the beginning of effects big and small from bullet train construction.
Even if you never set foot on a high-speed train, its power could ripple into your life. Visible construction is set to begin in downtown Fresno at the start of the year. The High Speed Rail Authority will begin destruction of the outdated Tuolumne Street Bridge that currently carries traffic over the existing railroad tracks.
Because our train, we would not then be able to run at high speeds. And as part of the safety requirements, in order for us to run at 220 miles, nobody can stop for our train. So you either have to go over or under us. So that is the big safety benefit.
Diane Gomez with the High Speed Rail Authority says the bridge will close for a year, forcing drivers to find other ways to get around downtown. Once reopened, it and Tuolumne Street will both convert from one-way to two-way traffic. But this bridge merely signals the start of many more changes coming to Fresno in the next year. Gomez points out that numerous streets from downtown to Herndon and beyond will soon become underpasses or overpasses to make way for the train. Bridges will span both the Union Pacific tracks and the new high-speed tracks.
And that is the one benefit of our project, is nobody will have to wait for a train anymore at Herndon, at Shaw, at McKinley, at Olive. So nobody will have to wait for a train anymore in the city of Fresno along the UP corridor, not even in the downtown area.
While multiple streets will go over the tracks, a couple, such as Herndon, Tulare, and Ventura, will go under. Gomez says whether to go over or under is based on construction constraints. The more heavily traveled roadways, like Shaw and Herndon, will remain in operation during construction. A section of Golden State Boulevard will permanently close and be replaced with high-speed tracks. Also, the train will run in a deep trench along the side of Roding Park. Another major change that will be beginning in early spring is bumping a 2.5-mile section of Highway 99 about 100 feet to the west. It sounds simple, but it's not like playing with child's toys, says Garth Fernandez with Caltrans.
It's the time it takes to actually physically do it. It's so easy when you get to pick something up and put it over there. When you actually have to do this,
it's not Tonka trucks.
It's not definitely not Tonka trucks. Those are the big trucks that you better get out of the way when they're coming to it.
Fernandez says moving a highway in an urban environment involves intensive prep work, moving utilities, demolishing buildings, and laying complex foundations for the new road, all while keeping the heavily traveled highway open.
We are not planning to shut down the highway completely, so we're going to build it incrementally. So we'll build the new section, a piece of the new section, we'll move traffic over to the new section, and then we'll work on the old section. So we plan to maintain three lanes of traffic on 99 at all times.
There are still some properties that have not been acquired for the project, but Fernandez is confident they will all be purchased by the time construction begins in April. Effects on highway travel will simply involve paying attention to lane patterns, but bigger changes are also coming for on-ramps. Several are closing for good, and one confusing and complicated ramp at Clinton Avenue is being completely demolished and rebuilt. Although road construction is perhaps the most notable impact coming to Fresno in the next year, the rail construction will also lead to smaller but important changes.
Okay, we are at the corner of Railroad Avenue and Van Ness Boulevard, standing in front of the Van Ness Avenue Arch.
That's Sally Caglia. Her father was instrumental in saving a historic sign welcoming visitors to Fresno, which it calls the best little city in the USA, along what was once the main entrance to the city. When the high-speed rail comes through, the road it is on will dead-end, leaving a welcome sign with no one to welcome. High-speed rail has agreed to move the sign, likely to Mariposa Street, directly in front of what will eventually be the main train station. Caglia is pleased the sign, which has been the frequent target of thieves and vandals, is being saved, calling it a piece of Fresno's soul.
The realization now is we need to preserve and protect these historic pieces of Fresno history, so we have our identity and we know where we are and who we are and what those meant to us.
At least five streets in downtown will not get bridges, and they will close permanently at the tracks. It's not clear how much it will cost to move and renovate the sign, or if the decades-old landmark can even survive the relocation. Detailed maps and links to the projects and detours are available at kvpr.org. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Talk to water experts throughout the state, and they'll all tell you the same thing. Even if El Nino delivers massive rain and snow to California this season, it won't be enough to end California's drought, at least not now. However, it could be the start of a turnaround in water conditions, or at least that's the hope of just about everyone, from farmers to city residents. One thing the drought has done is bring the sometimes arcane world of water policy and politics to the fore. As we enter 2016, we thought we'd take a look at just that issue with Fresno Democratic Representative Jim Costa, who joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Congressman Costa, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back on Valley Public Radio.
It's pretty clear right now that there will be no new water bill in 2015 after negotiations between Senator Feinstein and Majority Leader McCarthy fell through earlier this month. There was an added sense of urgency, however, this month as El Nino is on the brink of hitting California. How concerned are you that this El Nino is going to be a wasted opportunity when it comes to capturing some of that water for the valley?
Well, I'm very concerned, and that's why this last week, I spent time working with all of the parties to try to see where we can put together a short-term and hopefully a longer-term package that would address our water needs now, and then also try to begin fixing our broken water system over the long term in terms of adding supply and surface reservoirs, groundwater banking, greater water efficiencies in urban areas, and recycling programs, reuse programs, and the like. But today, we are faced with a situation where we could have an abundance of rain and snow in the mountains over the next 4 months, and we hope that's the case. But our ability to, in the short term, move the water through the delta to get it into San Luis Reservoir and to other parts of our valley that desperately are in need of that water are very limited by all of the constraints that are placed upon the movement of water because of the Biological Opinions and the Endangered Species Act. And these negotiations that you noted a moment ago have not only been involved for the last 6 weeks or so, but really for over a year. Last year, we were kind of hoping that we were going to have a breakthrough, and it didn't happen. And then, of course, we've had conversations over the course of many months. And some of us, of course, have been working on this for years. And clearly, if it was easy, it would have been done a long time ago, as I tell folks. And if it were just the Valley delegation making the determination, we would have reached an agreement years ago. But the problem is that we have to convince our colleagues, both in the South and in the Bay Area, and our two United States senators, that we need to create this greater operational flexibility in the short term to move water. And I believe Senator Feinstein is there trying to get support both in Sacramento with the Brown administration and with Senator Boxer has been the challenge. And but I'm not giving up because, frankly, the easiest thing to do is to point fingers and to put the political blame on someone else's doorstep. But that doesn't bring us one more drop of water. And I'm focused on trying to bring some water in an area that has had a zero allocation. I'm talking about our valley, both on the east side and the west side, for not only last year but the year before. And the last thing that we want to see happen is a third year in which we have a zero allocation. Well, we're having an abundance of an El Nino effect that is providing rain throughout California and snow in the mountains. It's unconscionable that that would take place this next spring, and it's avoidable even within the existing framework. If we could pump 5,000 minus cubic feet per second when we have the pulse flows, when we're not endangering through the biological opinions, we could potentially have anywhere from 800,000 to 1 million acre feet of water move through the system that we don't have today. That's significant. That would provide some water allocation under the Central Valley Project, both on the east side and west side, because the alternative, and this is what I continue to press home with our two United States senators and with the Brown administration in Sacramento, is that we could have this above average event with the El Nino over the course of the next 5 months and find ourselves in a situation where the senior rights water holders, they're called the exchange contractors, they could get 100% of their allocation. The state could have as much as maybe 20% of their water allocation, and everybody else would have a zero. And that would simply be an impossible situation for our farmers and farm communities and the farm workers that they employ. Absolutely unconscionable. And that's what I'm trying to avoid.
If when the House and Senate resume their work in Washington and this water bill comes back up, is it too late at this point for the 2016 year to try to get some of these operational things taken care of, or are you still optimistic at this point?
Well, I don't think it's too late, but certainly we have an uphill climb. There's the possibility that we could look at legislation separately, dealing only with a limited effort on a on the operations to provide that flexibility. If we could act in January, we could possibly ensure that in February, March, and April that we would have that ability to move water when we would not be threatening the species through the biological opinion, because you would pump when the fish were not located where the pumps are. And if it was determined through real-time monitoring that the fish were at the intake levels, then you wouldn't pump. That's all contained in the proposed language that we're talking about. If there's a Western States water bill that Senator Murkowski is trying to work on in later January, we might be able to get something by February. But clearly, as we look at February, March, and April, when we're going to get the most amount of flows, if that operational flexibility that we think is necessary is not there, then we will have lost a significant opportunity to move anywhere from 500,000 acre feet of water more or maybe less down through the Delta into San Luis Reservoir that we would not have today.
There was an editorial in the LA Times back in July that repeated something I've heard a number of people say, mainly people from outside of the valley, but something to the effect of, the House wants to see us build new storage, new dams, yet we can't even fill the dams we have right now, therefore we shouldn't build them. Does that illustrate the problem that you and your colleagues face?
Well, that's part of the problem. Clearly, if we had additional storage capacity in Shasta, if we had Temperance Flat constructed, if San Luis Reservoir, which in the budget bill that we passed on Friday provides authorization of language that will allow us to expand San Luis Reservoir. That's one thing, good thing that came out of the budget bill that I voted for on Friday. We'd have more carryover water today, even after four consecutive dry years. So that surface storage, if in fact it existed, would be part of our savings account that would still put us in a difficult position, but yet it would be more manageable. The fact is we have a broken water system. It was conceived in the 30s, and then after World War II, the ability to put the legislation to finance it and construct it in the 50s took place, and both at the federal and the state level. But it was designed for a California that had 20 million people and had the agriculture that we had in the 60s. And today we have 40 million people, and we have a much more intense agricultural economy that provides half the nation's fruits and vegetables and a tremendous amount of food products throughout the world. But the problem is that it's unsustainable because it's oversubscribed. When you look at the doubling of the population of the state, and when you look at the agriculture, and even though we're as water efficient as we possibly can be, and there are still some things we can do, we have more demands on it and from the environment. And we've got to make some determinations here on how we improve our water system that will allow us to maintain our agriculture economy and also deal with the environmental issues that are out there and provide water for our growing population. We're going to have 50 million people in California by the year 2030. The other part of it, you talk about the LA Times. As I said earlier, if it were just the Valley delegation passing the legislation by ourselves, we would have fixed this. But 1.5% of the population of California is directly involved in the production of food and fiber. And so over 98% of the people who live here have no direct contact. I mean, they may have known a farmer, or maybe a grandfather was involved in farming. They think, for the most part, that their food comes out of a grocery store. So when you only have 1.5% of the population in this state that is the eighth largest economy in the world, that is the number one agricultural state in the world, producing over $54 billion last year at the farm gate, still with 1 million acres of very rich, productive agricultural land that has gone fallow this year, out of production, 1 million out of 6 million acres, and yet continuing to be resilient, people take it for granted. People take, you know, I mean, we got plenty of food. I go to the grocery store. I don't see any empty shelves there. And that's the challenge. We've got to do a better job of educating people in the urban areas, the consuming public, as to where their food comes from. And the fact that if we don't fix this broken water system, the ability to maintain and sustain, sustain's the key word here, that agricultural production is going to be in question.
You mentioned Temperance Flat. I want to talk about this. There was a piece on Monday in the New York Times talking about the challenges of trying to deal with storage. We're talking about a project here that would cost about $2.5 billion by some estimates. It would generate, though, on average, a little over 70,000 acre feet of new available water for both farmers and the environment. Now, that may seem like a lot of water, but in the big picture of what California water picture looks like, it's really just a small fraction. There's some people who say that that's not worth it. The cost for construction of something like Temperance Flat just doesn't pencil out. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I think that response doesn't take into account the sophistication and the complexity of California's water system. There is not one single solution to California's water challenges over the next century. Therefore, we have to use all the water tools that are in our water toolbox. And storage, like Temperance Flat, is one of those tools in our water toolbox. But if we are going to create a sustainability here, it's going to involve a host of efforts in that water toolbox. Surface storage is one of them. Groundwater storage is another. More efficient water use, both in our agricultural application as well as in our urban use. And in our urban use, that involves reuse of water, gray water, as well as better recycling of water for both commercial purposes. It involves desalinization for those coastal communities where you can pencil those numbers out. It involves transferring water. It also involves the ability to better manage our groundwater. There is not one single solution. The water's gotten so expensive that farmers are using every economic efficiency tool that they can afford to implement because that water is so valuable. And so, you know, the old days about, wasting water is simply when you put 1 million acres of productive land and you don't plant it, it's, you know, talks about how catastrophic this devastating drought has become for our valley. Let me add one other factor, because there were other criticism that, you know, I remember years ago, you shouldn't grow cotton. Cotton's a water waster. And this last year, we've heard people say we shouldn't grow almonds. Almonds, it takes a gallon of water to grow one almond. And that's true. By the way, it takes 38 gallons of water to grow one glass of wine. And it takes 3 gallons of water to grow one tomato. What the average person doesn't know today is that it takes about 1,200 gallons of water to produce about 1,000-calorie diet a day. So while, you know, we as people can get away with maybe using 50 gallons of water a day, you know, for our own personal use, for the consumption of our breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and a balanced diet daily is about 1,200 calories, you got to use 1,200 gallons of water for that. And a lot of people consume a lot more than 1,200 calories a day. You know, you just I try to remind people. Yes, but it also takes over 1,000 gallons of water to produce 4 tires for your car. And so people lose sight of that fact. But if we don't fix this broken water system, our ability to produce half the nation's fruits and vegetables, our ability to be the number one dairy state in the union, our ability to continue to do so much efficiencies for good, nutritious, healthy food, it's going to change, and it's going to change in ways that not only affect California but affect the entire nation.
Before we go, just following up on the salmon issue, do you feel it's time to reopen the San Joaquin River Settlement Agreement? And you voted for the House bill when it was up earlier this year, and part of that was to develop a warm water fishery. Why do you think that's a good idea, and is it time to reopen that?
I think it's time to sit down and have a conversation about what's possible and what's not possible. In 2006 and 2007, we didn't have some of the studies that demonstrated the drier time periods that we're seeing today. The last time we've had this kind of dry 4 contiguous years together, some of the climatologists estimate was over 1,000 years ago. And so if we're embarking upon a drier period of time as we've had in previous centuries, and you add to that climate change, the ability to correct some of the environmental impacts or damages that have taken place is something that we ought to sit down and have a conversation about in California. What is possible and what's not possible? How do you provide a cold water, a sustainable cold water pool for the salmon? How do you deal? We didn't know about the totality of the impacts of the land subsidence, in which the river no longer maintains its same elevation for our ability to move water down it. And finally, the cost that was originally estimated to be between $400 and $500 million is now estimated to be in excess of $1.2 billion. And, you know, the verdict would not be known until close to the year 2030, whether or not you could create a sustainable salmon run, which the best biologists are guesstimating that might produce 500 salmon a year, maybe. So I think it's time that we sit down and have a conversation as to what makes the most amount of sense, what's possible, and what's not possible, and where, if we're trying to recreate salmon runs, where in what areas would we get the most effective use of our dollars that would take the ability to improve salmon populations in areas where they already exist. I don't think that should be necessarily a part of this legislation. Let me be clear about that. It has enough challenges on its own that I think we have to deal with that separately.
Congressman Jim Costa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to one and to all. And may the new year bring us health, good tidings, and an ability to work together better, as we should.
And hopefully some rainfall as well.
Lots of rain and snow on the mountains.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and take a look back at the top stories of 2015 and let us know what you think made the news in this last year. You can tweet us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. Whether it's Kevin McCarthy or the Rough Fire, the UC Merced stabbing, or the gas pipeline blasts in Fresno and Bakersfield, tell us your top story. That's coming up in the next segment. Robert Price of the Bakersfield Californian and Evan Onstott of KC24 join us. Coming up next on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 2015 was filled with a number of big stories throughout the San Joaquin Valley. On today's program, our last live broadcast of 2015, I thought we'd take a look back at some of the biggest news events of the past year, both in the Fresno and Bakersfield markets. And here to do that in our studio, we have KC24 news anchor Evan Onstott, also host of Sunday Morning Matters on KC24. Evan, welcome back.
Hey, good morning. Thanks so much for having me back.
And on the phone with us from Bakersfield, Robert Price, the editor of the Bakersfield Californian. Robert, welcome back as well.
Thanks, Joe. Good morning.
A lot of big stories in 2015, from Kevin McCarthy's flirtation with the office of Speaker of the House to the stabbing at UC Merced, the high-speed rail groundbreaking in Fresno, oil prices in Bakersfield. I want to talk about a few of those in a bit, but I think one of the biggest ones that was a theme throughout 2015 has to deal with one of the biggest industries in this part of California, and that's agriculture, and the story of ag and water, and specifically, was 2015 the year of the almond? Evan, I'll throw that to you to start out with. But hear all of this about how much water it takes to grow an almond.
Yeah, a gallon per almond, right? Isn't that the saying? Which I think has some factual truth to it.
It does, in fact.
It does.
And that is something that the agriculture community really took quite a bit of beating in the media, both locally and nationally, over this year. Now that we have some perspective on it, looking back at that, did agriculture really get caught sort of flat-footed on that story, do you think?
I mean, perhaps. It turns out when there's not much water to go around, people start counting how much water it takes to grow some of these things. It takes a lot of water to grow a lot of things. And I believe the congressman was just talking about that in the last segment. But, I mean, it did hit hard. And I think that it was something that got a lot of people defensive. But at the same time, it didn't seem to make that much of an impact. Nobody's pulling out their almond orchards anytime soon because it makes money. You know, I spoke to some farmers that said, if there wasn't the market for it, I wouldn't do it. And so while they're thinking about conservation and they're thinking about being more efficient, they're putting in drip systems and using a lot of high technology in order to try to use as little of water as possible. And they are compared to what they used to be doing when these just flood the entire orchards. It's not like that anymore in a lot of spaces. But, you know, I mean, I think that it's still they're still using a lot of water and the market is allowing them to do that. And until it doesn't, they're going to keep doing that.
Robert, your thoughts on that? Was that one of the defining stories of this last year?
It was. When you said this is the year of the almond, you're right on the money. A good friend of mine is an almond broker, and he would agree it's the year of the almond for other reasons. The prices have been fantastic, and there's a lot of money to be made. And Evan, you're exactly right. It's going crazy, and as long as the prices are as strong as they are, people aren't going to worry that much about the water situation. Almonds do use a lot of water, but the agriculture industry has fought back a little bit by saying there's a whole bunch of other stuff that also uses a lot of water. And the bottom line is the valley needs water for all sorts of crops, and almonds is just one of them.
Moving on to another issue, this is something that, sort of looking back at some similarities between the top stories in the Fresno area and Bakersfield area, I saw one name that popped up, and he's not really the person that's been in the headlines himself, but he's sort of the driver behind this, and that's U.S. Attorney Benjamin Wagner. He not only wound up with an indictment on Fresno Deputy Police Chief Keith Foster for drug charges, but also virtually the same sort of story with another high-profile case in Bakersfield, and that's Bakersfield Police Detective Damasio Diaz. A big year for Benjamin Wagner, Bob Price. What do you think about the lasting legacy of this case? Certainly coming off the heels of the McFarland movie, it was a really sad event. Does this have repercussions throughout law enforcement?
Well, it's been a tough year for Kern County law enforcement in general, and you know, this is just sort of the cherry on top, to put it in a negative story in an odd way. Here's a hero. Here's a guy that the film just came out this year. It was well received. It was, frankly, a little better than I thought it would be, and then to have one of the heroes of the story end up in this way is, you know, kind of disappointing. The court case has to play itself out, obviously, but it's disappointing.
And, Evan, your thoughts? The Keith Foster story in Fresno really shook this community. He was quite possibly set to be the next police chief of Fresno, was very, very close to Chief Jerry Dyer, who said he had no knowledge of what allegedly was going on.
Yeah, and Jerry Dyer has had, despite all the things that are happening with local law enforcement across the country this year, his reputation is still very, very strong, the Fresno police chief. When this happened, though, that was a big, big hit to him, and it exposed some of the things that perhaps you can't keep an eye on everything and police everything perfectly. It's a big blow to a police department that largely has stayed out of the negative headlines in a lot of ways. This was their biggest negative headline, I think, by a country mile this past year. It's going to be interesting to see how Chief Dyer moves forward from this. I think he's rebounded pretty well. But going forward, it's just going to be interesting, you know, running for mayor, is that a possibility? Some other things. It doesn't seem to be slowing him down so far, but we'll see. Just like that other case, this has to play itself out, and it's probably got a long life in the courts.
We're talking about the biggest stories of 2015. We'd like to know your thoughts. You can tweet us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. And certainly from a local perspective, but also on the national level, one of the local stories that had the biggest national play, or maybe it's a national story that had the biggest local play, was that of Kevin McCarthy. In his bid to become Speaker of the House, at one point, it seemed all but certain. I remember 1 week we had NPR political analyst Ken Rudin on this program, and he said, "Joe, go to the bank. It's going to happen. McCarthy's going to be the next Speaker." And then almost as soon as he said that, the foibles popped up, and McCarthy's future became very much in doubt. Bob Price, looking back on that, have you seen a more remarkable political story, not just this year, but in recent memory here in the Valley, than Kevin McCarthy's very interesting 2015?
I don't remember a story like this ever coming out of the Valley. I had to go back to Earl Warren to see someone who's come so close to the pinnacle of power. Truly, truly amazing. I mean, Kevin could have been just a couple steps away from the presidency, and then it all just sort of collapsed in just a weekend, it seemed like.
Definitely. And what's the feeling in Bakersfield right now in terms of his constituency? Certainly a very popular politician, and he's got a strong base of support in local Republican circles. Did this hurt him in any way, or is this something a politician brushes off after the news cycle moves on? And certainly he's moving forward as majority leader right now.
Well, he is very popular. Yeah, I've been to a lot of, rubber chicken dinners that he's been at, and he continues to be very popular. I think it does hurt him. He bumped his head on the ceiling, and just as far as he goes. As far, he's come pretty far, though. So, he's a hometown boy and very much loved and respected, and he'll come out of it fine.
Looking at some other stories in the Valley that made big headlines, One of the things just in the last month or so, but I think it definitely it's a defining story of this year, Evan, is the story about the Somerset Village Apartments in Fresno. This is an apartment complex of a couple of hundred units or so in the heart of the city in an older neighborhood that's seen some struggles. Over 1,000 people living there, many of them Southeast Asian immigrants, and for almost a month they were without natural gas for heat, for hot water, for cooking. Really not just the Somerset Village story, though, but the larger issue of quote-unquote slumlords in Fresno. Is this something that we're going to not only see this year, Evan, but also in 2016 as a major theme in this city?
Well, I think a lot of people are hoping that it's a major theme going forward because, I mean, there's been people in Fresno that have been chipping away at city leadership, trying to get them to be serious about keeping people accountable when it comes to living conditions that are humane, that are legal, that, you know, are just within the law. And there was a lot of frustration. And it took this, to be honest, this humanitarian disaster that happened at Somerset Village Apartments, you know, for the city to take some serious action. And that's what a lot of people are saying. And by all accounts, I believe the city is taking serious action. They've created a new code enforcement strike team. It's only a couple people, but it's some of the more experienced people. They're going to be reporting directly to the city manager himself. And they are going to be knocking on doors here within the next, I think, just a few weeks without warning. They said the warning's already been issued and that if there are things that are not up to code, there will be serious repercussions. Now, how seriously are they going to be following this? Bruce Rudd, the city manager, told me this code enforcement team, this has teeth. We're going to be bringing in, you know, the city attorney's getting involved. We're going to be changing some of these code laws. We're going to be changing what we can do about it so we can get tougher. Is that going to happen? There's a lot of people that criticize city leadership and the mayor's office as being too cozy with developers. And so we'll see where this goes from here. A lot of people are hopeful, though, that this could be, unfortunately, it took, again, a bad event, that it could be the change that Fresno has been wanting for quite some time and needs, to be honest.
That voice you hear is KC24 News anchor Evan Onstott joining us today on Valley Public Radio, talking about the top stories of 2015. Also on the phone with us is Robert Price, the editor of the Bakersfield Californian, looking back at 2015 with an eye ahead to the next year. And Bob, another one of the big stories this year in Kern County has absolutely have to be the collapse of oil prices and the effect that has on the economy and also local governments' budgets and their ability to provide services. Looking ahead to 2016, is this a story that continues even if oil prices in the future go up? The ripples from the low prices we've seen will continue for the future. Is that a safe assessment?
It takes a while for the economy to catch up with the direction of oil prices. It didn't seem like it took very long for the economy to start struggling when oil prices dropped. But I think typically I've seen this cycle over many years. It'll take a while for the economy to catch up once oil prices rebound, and I think they will rebound. But you know, we're kind of moving into a different era here. I mean, climate change legislation is really taking hold in California, and it's hitting Kern County very, very hard. Renewable energy is picking up steam. And, you know, I don't know if it'll ever be quite the same here in Kern County, but I believe the prices will rebound somewhat. And, local government and the general economy really needs that to happen.
You mentioned the overall political winds that are blowing right now in Sacramento. There was a big push this year to put this cap in fossil fuel usage in transportation vehicles. Henry T. Perea led the successful effort to essentially gut that bill. The bill wound up passing without those provisions in it. Perea wound up resigning. Evan, I'll ask you about that in a moment, but I want to just follow up with what Robert Price said. What movement is there, or is there any movement in the Kern County economy right now to try to look at, well, do we need to do more to diversify the economy? Certainly ag is huge. What else is on the horizon? Or is this even a conversation people are having?
Well, it's a conversation I've tried to jumpstart as best I can for a long time. And yes, we very much need to diversify. It's oil and agriculture and not a whole lot else. Transportation, warehousing, is is pretty big. You know, the problem is that Kern County has a fairly low educational attainment level. There aren't the kind of employees here that would tempt a Silicon Valley type company to come and set up shop. There are a few that are here, but you know, we're kind of locked into you know, the big two, the big three, and we very much need to diversify. I know they're working real hard at the Kern Economic Development Corporation to do that. But it's tough. It's tough. A lot of poverty in this area, in this part of the valley, poverty all over the valley, and low educational attainment levels, and language barriers, and it all adds up to a pretty tough nut to crack.
Evan Onstott, Henry T. Perea's surprise resignation, certainly a big political story this year. How do you think we'll remember him and his legacy in Sacramento?
I think he's going to be remembered as somebody who carved out a role of influence for himself and for more business-friendly Democrats from the Valley, mostly inland Democrats, not from the coast. He was the leader of the moderate Democrats, the Valleycrats, the new Democrats is what they like to call themselves this time. And he's actually, his leadership position is now being replaced by two people. So yeah. I think that might be something to show just how influential this group has become. I don't know locally how people are going to feel about him going forward. Nobody likes somebody that just quits a full year before their term is over, especially when they're doing it for what could be, people are looking at it is just a money run. Of course, he's providing for his family, and apparently whatever job he's taking next, I don't think he's announced it yet. I've been looking for that, but it's probably, he says it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing that could be a rest of his career sort of thing. So good for him, but sometimes when people say, stop it with all this talk about, you know, it's public service and I'm always just thinking about the public. You're like, well, you can't do that and then say that at the same time. So I think there's a lot of frustration with that. But he did a lot of things. He passed a lot of big legislation for the Valley. He stood up for issues. And in the end of the day, when you can stand up to the governor and win on something, that's saying something about yourself and your role of influence. So I think he's going to go down very much so in the history books.
Certainly an interesting parallel with Michael Rubio from a few years ago when Rubio also resigned after a fight over those issues, except in this case, Rubio lost. Perea got his objectives into law, or actually, well, prevented that law from being implemented. Robert Price, another issue that's related to the oil economy and the county's budget is the way that Kern County in 2015 looked at what it is doing, its services that it provides, including libraries, including Kern Medical Center. Do you think this push to at least explore privatization, public-private partnerships, is this going to be a trend that we see in the new year as well?
I expect it will. The issue over the libraries that you mentioned is an ongoing thing. I think that we can only benefit from this discussion, though, if it turns out that privatization is the way to go. That there's that, and then but there's also efforts to maybe create a quarter cent sales tax or some kind of sales tax that would enable the county to fund libraries, and that'll be sort of a referendum on how people feel about libraries, and I'm hopeful that that'll generate some good discussion. It's a tough time for government everywhere, and especially in Kern County, and with oil prices, it's necessary to start thinking about things like privatization, and in the case of Kern Medical Center, an independent authority, semi-independent authority that runs the county to kind of get it off the county's back a little bit.
Looking at some other issues, there were a couple of scandals, Evan, in the Fresno area, one involving Mayor Swearingen and the payment of bonuses to top city employees that apparently no one in the public really knew about. And then there was also the case of Fresno Unified Superintendent Michael Hansen and the district's handling of no-bid construction contracts, currently the subject of a federal investigation. Obviously, that has some legs that will go into 2016 unless we get some pronouncement from the feds over the next few days. What do you think the long term, you know, as we look back on this, looking back at 2015, at those two things, what stands out for you there?
What stands out is that nothing really is going to happen because of it. Michael Hansen was just given a contract extension, despite being under investigation by the FBI, despite, remember, the cyber dust app thing that he completely shrugged off. But some people on the board of, you know, of the school district board was saying this is horrendous. That is the app in which he and other key members of the district were using, this app that deleted their communications immediately after they sent to each other, which he says it was not illegal. It's definitely shady, because really any official communication they have should be recorded. It's electronic communication, so that if we ask for a record of it, they should be able to provide it. But, and then you look at the mayor, you know, with what happened with the bonuses, the only thing that's really going to happen there, because I think the mayor's relationship with the council is strong still at this point, but they agreed that they're just not going to do that anymore. They're going to find a different way to pay the people that they want to keep and stuff like that. So I don't see long-term repercussions. We'll see what happens with Fresno Unified. But right now, I mean, there's absolutely no indication that anything that happens, unless there's a huge fallout from whatever the feds come up with, is going to stick to the superintendent or anything like that.
We're talking about the top stories of 2015. This is not a scandal per se, but maybe a black eye for city leaders in Bakersfield. The 24th Street widening project is something that a lot of people have been looking forward to for years. The city did their environmental study and started buying up property. And then the court said, no, not so fast. How does this play out? How do you see this playing out, Robert Price? And is this something that is a black eye for the city in some way?
Well, I think it is a black eye for the city. I think they got caught sort of trying to push this through a little bit faster than they should have. It's always good to look at all the options, and as far as routes to circumvent the city. Eventually, it would be nice to have a transportation system that allows people to actually get from one side to the other, and this is going to be a key component. And the city tried to push it through because it takes years, even in the best of scenarios. But they kind of got caught with their pants down a little bit, and I would still like to see some sort of way to get from the northwest part of Bakersfield to downtown Bakersfield, and that is the most straight-ahead route. But, they need to do it right, and it's a historic neighborhood that they are carving a slice through to make it happen. So they need to do it the right way.
Does that foreshadow any potential problems with the Centennial Corridor project, another even more high-profile roads project in Bakersfield that's been going on, at least in the planning stages, for years? The city is also buying property for that as well. Residents in that community, some of them are sort of have acquiesced to the changes that are proposed. Others are still very upset.
There was a pretty good fight from that neighborhood as well. Same kind of story. It does seem as though that's going to happen, and that will be a vital component of this plan. The truth is, there's just no way to put this sort of network together over the grid of a city that's already established without having some pain. And those folks, unfortunately, are experiencing it. And 24th Street, those folks over in the Westchester, Central Bakersfield part of town, are also dealing with it. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you put a city together like that after it's already been established. I wish, the city fathers 50 years ago had laid down some plan lines, do not build in these areas because we have plans for it. But I don't know. Does anybody ever do that anywhere? That would be a good idea.
Exactly. Another high-profile story that your paper did a great job covering was the case and the trial of the Taft High School shooter, Brian Oliver, got 27 years in prison. That really captivated the community's interest and certainly the tragic event that happened there several years ago. Looking back on that now, that trial, does it stand out to you as one of the most memorable in recent years?
Well, it was. It was one of the trials of the year, no doubt, and it just kind of reminded us here that nobody is exempt from these kind of things. It could have been so much worse. This particular case could have been so much worse. We're seeing cases like it all over the country that many are worse. It just reminds us it can happen anywhere, and we have a problem here. And I don't know if it's guns, if it's bullying. I just don't know what it is, but we're all susceptible to it.
In the few minutes that we have left, turning back to Evan Onstott politics, always a fluid situation in the Valley. We're always looking at who's running, who's not. What are maybe some of the biggest political stories of 2015 is now that we look back on it from your view? Winners, losers this year. We're still looking for, or at least Democrats are looking for, who's going to be their preferred challenger against David Valadao in that hotly contested congressional race. Is that maybe one of the political stories of the year for you, or is it something else?
No, I think it is, because you sense this discontent within the Democratic Party of who they're running against Valadao this time. You know, it's Daniel Parra, of course. Mayor Pro Tem Fowler, he is the announced candidate, but there hasn't been a lot of traction behind him so far. We'll see if he can gather some. But I know out of the Bakersfield area, they keep trying to bring up these people to run against him, and so far none of them have stuck. And so we'll see what happens. I think another thing that we're going to be looking for big time in 2016 is how the presidential nomination and the presidential race affects voter turnout for local races as well. Say Donald Trump is the nominee for president for the Republicans. What does that do for races in California, you know, that have nothing to do with him, but obviously people are coming out to vote in November and they'll be voting as well. Does Donald Trump bring in an incredible amount of, say, Democrat Latino voters that will help Democrats out across the state? It's going to be really interesting to see how this national election plays out on the local scene.
Robert Price, we have about a minute left. Your thoughts on that race in particular, finding a challenger for David Valadao and politics as we look ahead into 2016. Is Emilio Huerta the answer for Democrats?
I don't know, but I do know that, last time when Amanda Renteria ran, I mean, she was a very strong candidate, very well qualified, well funded, local, probably would have been an excellent congresswoman, and for Valadao to have so decisively beaten her, I mean, that sends a message, I think, to Democrats that, wow, this guy might be here for a while. And, you know, meanwhile, David is just sort of going along his merry way, seems to be doing his job. His demeanor suggests that he plans to stick around. So it'll be a tough one for the Democrats in that race, I think.
Robert Price is the editor of the Bakersfield Californian. Evan Onstott is a news anchor with KC24 and the host of Sunday Morning Matters on Sundays right after Meet the Press. And Evan will I'll actually be a guest on Evan's show this week, so we're looking forward to that.
Very much so.
And recapping 2015 on television as well. Thank you both so much for joining us. That's all for today's Valley Edition. I'd like to thank you for tuning in this year. As always, you can send us your thoughts and comments, email talk@kvpr.org, and send us a tweet @kvpr. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.